Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Anthropologist Cliff Hickey is heading to Mexico, but he won't be spending much time on the beach. In fact, he might be fighting off bandidos who steal logs from Mexico's forests. The Mexican government is hopeful that Cliff and his team from Canada's Sustainable Forest Management Network can help them develop a better, more lawful approach to forestry in their country. And reclaimed watersheds in Alberta's north caught the attention of hydrologists who were in Edmonton recently for the International Instrumented Watershed Symposium. Dr. David Chinasek and Oregon scientist Dr. Jeff McDonald talk about what's new on the watershed front. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. For several years now, the Sustainable Forest Management Network has brought together researchers with people in industry, First Nations communities, and conservation organizations. Their objective is to develop a new, science-based approach to forest management. As part of a national program, the Networks of Centers of Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network has attracted international attention on many fronts. Dr. Cliff Hickey is a professor emeritus in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Alberta, and he's the SFM's research leader in the area of sustainable Aboriginal communities. He's currently heading a delegation to Mexico.
We are a rather unique enterprise. The whole Network of Centers of Excellence program is unique to Canada, and our network is quite unique. And there doesn't exist anything like it anywhere. But the Mexican authorities were very interested in the concept of the network because they had just adopted a new general law covering forest management in Mexico. And this, they saw, might be a means to implement it because it is a very inclusive process, bringing in the many stakeholders in forest management.
How big an industry is forestry in Mexico?
It's a very important industry, and it's worth several billions of dollars. But it's quite unorganized in a sense that the whole land tenure and resource tenure system is so different from us that and probably because of the one-party rule for so many years, that it's in quite a lawless state right now. And this is the kind of thing that worries us a little bit about getting into it. But if there's some way that we can help to bring harmony to this whole thing by bringing different perspectives and ways to bring people together, well, we're willing to try it.
What are the Mexicans interested in?
Approximately 55% of the forested lands in Mexico are owned by communities. This is completely foreign to the Canadian experience, where we have natural resources owned by the provinces. States down there, not provinces, own something like 10 to 12%, and private landholders own around 25%, and then there are minor holdings by the federal government and a few other players. But because of the predominance of community tenures, it's almost like any kind of rules may be formulated for the use of resources. Unfortunately, this is sometimes taken advantage of by governments or by private industry who may, well, commit, I suppose you could say, a lot of illegal acts. There is a lot of piracy, and it's kind of dangerous in some of those forests. Recently, Vicente Fox sent in soldiers to try to stop the harvesting in some of the monarch butterfly forests because they're disappearing at a very rapid rate. These are being actively resisted, shall we say, by mafia-type groups.
This sounds dangerous.
Oh, yeah, it could be. I think that in most cases, and especially in the places where I'm planning to go after we attend the Forestry Expo at the community's invitations, I think they pretty much got things in hand. They seem to be quite organized, and they don't seem to have the same sort of piracy that's going on in some places. But, yeah, it's not undangerous, I suppose.
What sort of research have the Mexicans been undertaking that would relate to the type of work that you're doing and the network is doing in terms of forest research and how different people react with the forest?
Well, right now they seem to be at a slightly different stage in the development of forest management than we are. We are really looking at ecological, economic, and social issues in forest management, trying to make them sustainable on all three of those pillars of sustainability. Their concern right now is trying to develop the best economics, because that's what they're most in need of. That includes, though, some things like forest genetics. They want to be able to produce the best possible trees with the shortest possible growing spans and that sort of thing. They're also interested in issues of conservation and restoration for some of the reasons I've given before, that there just hasn't been real management. It's been a very local issue, and in some places its resources have been pillaged. There's a long history to this in Mexico, unfortunately, because during the colonial period, forests were used to support especially mining industries. And so there's terrible erosion as a result, not only of the mining, but also deforestation. And some of these areas are just now trying to get back into what we would see as sustainability. So some of the issues are the same, but some are quite different.
For the way that the Sustainable Forest Management Network is set up in Canada, would that be able to work exactly the same way in Mexico? Or what would be the sorts of things that are unique to Mexico that they would have to look at and draw from what the SFM is doing?
Yeah, that's the issue, all right. We're certainly not going to have a clone of ourselves down there. What we'll do is work with them to develop the concept of a research network, so that both terms are really important. Clearly, the players are going to be different. Here, it's especially the provincial governments and then industry, who are assigned tenures by governments to develop resources. And then there are First Nations. There are NGOs like Ducks Unlimited and so on, who have a stake in forest management. There, it will be very strongly the communities. So how we can organize a series of representatives or in some way bring the communities in could be very difficult. There are the private landholders, and how would they be represented? Even the researchers themselves. We have most of the universities in Canada in the network here, but that won't do for Mexico, because the research versus higher education are different in Mexico. Most of the research is done via research institutes, and the training of graduate students is done in the universities, who then the students then have to work with researchers in the institutes. It might be the same. A professor could be a researcher in a research institute, but he might not be. So we'll have to accommodate that difference. And then the federal government probably could only be a kind of a coordinator in this. We'd have to bring in the Mexican states. There could be things like model forests. There are model forests in Mexico. We probably would want to bring them in, but it would look different.
This won't be your first trip down to Mexico. You do have some experience down there. What's it been like for you? Can you tell me a story?
Well, it was really interesting. I mentioned the importance of the private landholders, and we were given a couple of tours. One was a marvelous one to a distillery in the town of Tequila, but I won't go into that one. The other was to the lands of a fairly large landholder who was very much the prince of his principality. Not only did he give us a tour, but on a magnificent ledge overlooking this beautiful valley, he had some of his ranch hands set up a tent with tables and chairs, and the tequila was flowing and the steaks were barbecuing, and we just had a wonderful time. And you began to realize what it might have been like in, say, 15th century Spain.
Any indication at that time about the illegal logging?
Yes. While we were touring his lands, we came upon a fallen tree that had been shaped into a very nice rounded log and was ready for taking. And so on the way back, we helped him load it into his truck and took it off. He had indicated that this was a problem, although for him it wasn't as large as it is in some places, but he had tried to inform the police about it. He'd taken photographs of people and their license plates and given it all to the police, but they were doing nothing about it.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's the social situation in Mexico. There is no system of government support. There's no social insurance, welfare, that sort of thing. In fact, really, beyond working for their entire lives for themselves, about the only social support that many people have is income generated by immigrants to the United States, Canada, and other countries. So it's if people are falling on hard times, they look to things like piracy of trees.
It looks like you've really got a long road to hoe going down there. What do you think you really have to offer?
Well, alternative perspectives. As an anthropologist, this is one of the things I treasure about the diversity of human cultures, that there are so many different ways to be human. And we might certainly make judgments about some of those ways, but just to see things differently, we treasure that. One of my research team is, in fact, a Mexican anthropologist who I met down there last year, but who is here this year because her husband is taking an engineering degree and a master's degree. But we hope to build our research team with Mexican researchers down there. We don't want to have Canadians doing this for them, although we do have one Canadian here going down in the research team to handle ecological affairs. But we really want to build that local expertise in that sense of working as a multidisciplinary team.
And what's the focus of that research project?
Well, that's part of the reason we're going down. We met them last year, and they asked us if I would be willing to do research with them. And I indicated that if we could reconcile priorities and figure out financing, I'd certainly be willing to do it. So we've been emailing each other back and forth during the year, and we did set up the research team. We got some money from the network to do some traveling down there and to go visit and establish research priorities. And if we can reconcile their priorities, local ones, with ours as a network, I think we will do something because the network is quite favorable to the opportunity.
The Mexicans want to learn from us, but what do you think the Sustainable Forest Management Network can learn from the Mexicans?
Thank you very much. I really like that question because one of the main reasons I'm interested in actually working with this community is that it is so different from the Canadian experience. We have almost nothing like community tenures in this country, and yet we're under terrific pressure to change our forestry tenure situation because of things like the softwood lumber situation with the United States. British Columbia is changing its tenure. The government of Alberta says it's looking at it, but it certainly won't go the BC way. A lot of things are up in the air. I think that if we were more exposed to local tenures, we might be more willing to sort of devolve responsibility to more local situations where people who are the genuine stakeholders locally would be charged with management of their territories. And that includes, of course, First Nations who have specific rights in this area. So I really want to work with communities and do more work on the literature on community tenures internationally and start to inform the Canadian situation that way. So Mexico's a great way to start that.
Have a good trip. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gerald.
That was Dr. Cliff Hickey, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Alberta and Research Leader for the Sustainable Forest Management Network on Sustainable Aboriginal Communities. Edmonton was recently the gathering point for hydrologists from around the globe who were attending the International Instrumented Watershed Symposium. The symposium was organized by the Oil Sands Environmental Research Network at the University of Alberta, Dr. David Chinasek is the network's director.
The original idea stemmed from research that I, as a researcher, and several others from the U of A and also University of Saskatchewan are conducting with Syncroot, and we have instrumented watersheds. And we were discovering that we wanted to share ideas and gain ideas of innovative ideas related to instrumentation. Less emphasis on results, but much more on the actual instrumentation that we use to collect some of the key data we need.
What is an instrumented watershed? What kind of instruments would you use?
It's a variety. The major ones relate to basically flow from the watershed. So what are the volumes and rates in which water come off? It could also be related to water quality. It could be related to soil moisture. It could be groundwater. It could be almost any of these. Could be vegetation as well.
Now, I've noticed on your agenda that you've had people talking about their work in natural watersheds, but also a key part of this is dealing with what's happening in reclaimed watersheds. And you have people from around the world who are speaking to this issue. What are some of the things that you've learned from the people in, say, Australia or Germany?
It seems to me that we're all concluding that what we are trying to do is very complex and that each of us have our unique challenges within watersheds. We are certainly recognizing the challenges we face with respect to both temporal and spatial variability in properties and actually effects of weather and climate over the longer run. So just the sharing of ideas of how individuals face the challenges that they face in their watersheds.
What's happening in northern Alberta?
The impetus from this was basically the recognition that the oil sands are a huge land disturbance that goes on and that we're actually changing the hydrology quite dramatically. So it's a matter of looking at it, and we need to remember that once the disturbance is made, there is the potential to recreate almost anything that we want. And it's a fascinating challenge, because if somebody asked, well, David, what is it that you think we should build, then those are the kind of questions that we're looking for. What are some of the advantages of a particular landform versus another? We need to remember that some of the oil sands soils are salinity challenged, and if it's a combination of salinity and dry conditions, vegetation may have a more difficult surviving, so we're looking at ways in which we can mitigate that as well.
What are some of the things that you found out so far?
With respect to these covers, there are scenarios in which the covers work very effectively. There's others that we recognize that at some times they will be challenged. It's also a recognition that the materials underlined, whether they are the saline sodic overburden or whether they're the saline tailing sands, that there will be salt movement, and that essentially part of our study is to find out how quickly those salts move and actually where they do move as well.
Any indications at this point?
Overall, I feel that there are indications that the reclamation techniques have been successful. We are in the earlier stages of plant development, succession, etc., so that I believe that the practices are ones that will produce the end result that we need. It is something, though, that we are, shall we say, cautiously optimistic, and essentially that's the part of our research, is to get some indication with some confidence 50 years from now in many areas, will we have a sustainable forest?
Do you know if in your research, if you're asking the right questions?
As scientists, I think we spend a lot of time asking ourselves that particular question. It's a fascinating one because it depends on the individual. We need to stop and ask who is asking that question. Is it a person working for the oil sands company? Is it a researcher? Is it a member of the general public? And actually the questions can be quite different depending who the individual is. But certainly within the research group, for example, meetings like this, that is one of the purposes, is to really, really get down to it. And this conference is is unique in the sense that we're emphasizing less the presentations and much more the question period, the discussion. Like, for example, tomorrow morning we will be having a panel discussion. That's something that I look forward to because it's much more a freewheeling discussion. And some of these people are very good out-of-the-box thinkers, so I'm looking forward to a lively discussion.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. David Chinasek, director of the Oil Sands Environmental Research Network at the University of Alberta and chair of the International Instrumented Watershed Symposium. One of the keynote speakers at the symposium was Dr. Jeff McDonald. Jeff is a professor at Oregon State University in the Department of Forest Engineering, and he holds a Richardson Chair in Watershed Science.
Well, I was invited up to talk about how we approach instrumented watersheds and perhaps speak about some new ways that scientists around the world are approaching the instrumentation of drainages, watersheds, and basins.
Why do we put instruments on them in the first place?
I guess it's to understand basic things like where does water go when it rains, how long does water reside in the catchment or in the watershed, and what flow path the water might take towards the stream. These are things that are fundamental to issues of water quantity and water quality.
Are we learning anything from this?
Yeah, I think we're learning a lot. What we're able to do from these instrumented watershed studies is to come up with models to predict in the future how our landscapes are going to respond to things like climate change or land use change or maybe contaminants that we might be adding to the system. And our instrumented watersheds provide a good barometer for how the natural world is working.
You're here giving a keynote address to the group. What is the message that you wanted to get across?
Yeah, I guess the message is that we've been instrumenting watersheds now in earnest for the past 40 or so years. This began with the first international hydrological decade that began in the 1960s. And during that 10-year period, I think about 3,000 or 4,000 watersheds around the world were gauged. These were largely what we would call headwater basins, small catchments in the upper parts of river systems to try to, again, quantify these inputs and outputs of water. The message that I'd like to bring to the meeting is that I think we need to really rethink the way we gauge and instrument watersheds and focus now on things like patterns and thresholds that perhaps we didn't understand back in the first days of gauging watersheds, but now we understand that these systems often respond to changes in climate, changes in land use in very unexpected ways, ways that are often show clear threshold-like responses where they could sit and be perhaps unresponsive to change, and then all of a sudden there's a tipping point, and now there's a very dramatic change, either in the quantity of water or quality of water that we might see in the stream.
Here at this meeting, there are people from Australia, Germany, Canada, and yourself from the United States. What are the things that people have to keep in mind if you're working in different countries, different part of the globe, different climates?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the way in which one might approach instrumenting a watershed or the way in which a landscape might respond to change, like mining, is going to be very different depending on the type of climate, the type of geology, the terrain, the topography of the area that you might be interested in mapping. One of the big things here in Alberta that I think is different perhaps to systems in the United States where I've worked is that they're very dry in that the amount of potential evaporation exceeds greatly the amount of precipitation that falls each year. So this makes for a very dry site, and the type of watershed behavior and the way that one might reclaim an area is really influenced by just the aridity of a site. Whereas if one was in a more humid environment where there was a lot more surface runoff, it could be very different dynamics in terms of response to reclaimed land.
In your work, in your research, is there something that stands out for you that has really surprised you or where we've really changed our perspective on things over the last 5 or 10 years?
Well, I think just in our understanding of the basics of how watersheds work, there have been some dramatic changes over the last decade or two. I think early on, much of the understanding of perhaps how a watershed responds to rainfall or snowmelt was based on the idea that water would run off over the soil surface and into the stream, and that the water in the stream would resemble the water that fell as rainfall or that melted as snow. What we find now is that in most humid areas, most of the water in the stream, even during a rain event or a big storm event where we have a flood perhaps passing through the system, most of that flood water is groundwater or water that was stored in the basin prior to the event. And this is a fundamental paradox now in terms of how watersheds work. They store water for months or years, but then release it on the order of minutes to hours in response to a flooding event. And this is something that I think that watershed hydrologists are trying to grapple with in terms of coming up with better understanding of these processes and then better mathematical models that might describe that, because this is fundamental to how we might understand the water quantity and water quality of our systems.
What are you going to take away from this conference, having met all these people now?
Well, a lot of good friendships and meeting a lot of interesting people. I think it's been interesting to be exposed to these managed systems and to start thinking about reclaimed landscapes and how we might engineer watersheds. Most of my work to date has been in natural systems, and I think seeing some of what Syncrude is doing in terms of sculpting new watersheds and catchments in and around these mine tailings has been really interesting in thinking about how we might apply some of the basic science of what we often gather into something that is direct response to some societal need, like how to deal with these tailings in an effective and ecologically sustainable manner.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jeff McDonnell, a professor in the Department of Forest Engineering at Oregon State University, where he holds a Richardson Chair in Watershed Science. I also spoke with Dr. David Chinasek, chair of the recent International Instrumented Watershed Symposium in Edmonton. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Alberta Research Council, the Science Alberta Foundation, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.